Well, hello there, little masters, and welcome back to the Prancing Pony Podcast, where today, well, we're going to be a bit like Frodo at dinner with Glowin, hearing the strange names of people and places we've never heard of before.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that intro. I was actually thinking a little bit more of Gildor's words to Frodo about how courage is found in unlikely places. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like maybe inspiration is a little bit like that, too, and we'll be talking a bit about that today. But first, I'm Sean Marchese, the real-life Lord of the Mark, and I'm here with the Man of the West, Alan Sisto.
And folks, today we are welcoming back a familiar voice to the Prancing Pony Podcast. He's our current record holder for the most special guest appearances on the show, and we first had him here back in Season 1, and then caught up to him again for quick interviews at Mythmoot 5, and then again last August at Tolkien 2019.
And now he's making his fourth appearance on the podcast and his second full episode interview. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking, of course, of the acclaimed writer, biographer, and editor, John Garth.
And now you know him best as the author of Tolkien and the Great War, the award-winning biography of Professor Tolkien's early life, and the impact of the war on the Middle-earth legendarium. He also authored Tolkien at Exeter College, the definitive account of Tolkien's undergraduate life at Oxford.
And he's received numerous awards from the Tolkien Society and the Mythopoeic Society, including a Mythopoeic Scholarship Award for Tolkien and the Great War, multiple Tolkien Society Awards for his many articles, and the 2017 Tolkien Society Award for Outstanding Contribution, all very well-deserved accolades.
Very well-deserved indeed. And now we're here to speak to him about his latest book, The Worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien, The Places That Inspired Middle-Earth. It's due out June 9th here in the States. And I have to say, we're not 100% certain exactly what the UK release date is, but we will know that soon. And once we do, we'll have that in our show notes for you.
What we can say without a doubt is that it is something you are going to want to get your hands on as soon as possible. And we are super excited to talk to him again and hear all about it. So let me say once again, John Garth, welcome back to the Prancing Pony Podcast.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I don't know if the blushes come across on radio, but they're certainly coming across to me here now.
We're going to go ahead and jump into questions in just a moment. But before we do, I want to remind our listeners that if you want to find out more about this new book by John Garth or any of the other books that we'll be talking about today, you're going to want to check out the official library page on our website, theprancingponypodcast.com. Now there we have links to every book we've mentioned on the show.
And there's a lot of other stuff on our website, too. We've got show notes and book links specific to each episode. We'll have some links up to John's website and his social media spaces as well. We've also got a lot of other stuff up there, outtakes, Prancing Pony ponderings, and a few other little extras. Mm-hmm. You'll also find a link to our online storefront at teespring.com/stores/PPP, where you can find shirts, mugs, stickers, and a lot of other great PPP gear. So please check that out.
Definitely. And now, let's get started. Now, the title of the new book is The Worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien, The Places That Inspired Middle-earth. Now, John, I'm sure many of our listeners already have it pre-ordered and are very much looking forward to reading it. But for those who aren't familiar with it yet, please give us your quick take on the book.
Well, this is a subject that obviously fascinates many, many people. And consequently, there's an awful lot of speculation, some excellent, some less so. Especially on the internet. There have also been several books on the subject, the pocket-sized books by Robert S. Blackham, Bob Blackham, of the Tolkien Society of Great Britain, and also a book called There and Back Again in the Footsteps of J.R.R. Tolkien by a British writer called Matthew Lyon, mm-hmm. which is more of a ruminative discussion of what it feels like to visit places Tolkien had visited, and that has plenty of speculation in it. Now, mine takes a very different tack, so the emphasis for me has not been on visiting places, but on researching Tolkien's connections with them and considering what a place means. So mm-hmm. a place involves not just geographical features mm-hmm. or a spot on the map, but mm-hmm. it's also a locus of cultural memory, a place of the environment, of the ecology. All of these things are really important and obviously very vital to Tolkien's imagination because he was so electrified by history and prehistory and by the natural world. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go in and examine everything mm-hmm. from that perspective. It's rather like what I do in Tolkien and the Great War mm-hmm. and in some of the essays that I've written, papers that I've given since then on the topic of the war, where I speculate, but with as much information as I can possibly bring to the table about the connections Tolkien's fiction has with the real world.
Mm-hmm. So that actually is a really good segue into my next question, because as you said, this isn't your first foray into Tolkien's real world inspirations. You did previously write Tolkien and the Great War, which looked at his wartime experience as one of his key real world inspirations to the Legendarium. I guess my next question for you would be, what is it that prompted you to specifically approach the idea of places as a next step? And how was this next study a logical next step from your previous work?
Well, it actually wasn't a logical next step, or it didn't seem so to me at first. The logical next step after Tolkien and the Great War is a book about the impact of the 20th century in general on Tolkien's work, particularly the conflicts of the 20th century. And that is what I was working on from 2015, when I had a fellowship at the Black Mountain Institute at the University of Las Vegas in Nevada. Mm-hmm. That book is still in progress, in hiatus at the moment. It's called Tolkien's Mirror. While I was writing that, a friend of mine, an old colleague from the London Evening Standard, mm-hmm. who writes books about English gardens for a publisher called Francis Lincoln, said to me that she thought her publisher would be really excited to be offered a book on Tolkien's landscape influences. Mm-hmm. The kind of book that you sit out on the coffee table,
right.
And it's full of mm-hmm. rich pictures and interesting text. This is exactly the kind of book they publish. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my first reaction to that was, what a stupid idea. But I sat back and I thought about it, and I thought, well, actually, you know, there is so much interest out there into this subject, but the quality of the speculation is very mixed, and it could do with some careful input. And I thought that I was quite well placed to do the kind of research necessary for that. And then when I looked at it further, I realized that there was material from Tolkien and the Great War that I had not used as fully as I wanted to there. Mm-hmm. There wasn't scope for that. Material from talks that I've given since then, or for research for talks that I've had to cut from those talks too. Material that I'd written while researching Tolkien's Mirror, which fits more happily in a book devoted to place rather than time. And of course, that brings out the other fact, which is rather neat, that Tolkien and the Great War and Tolkien's Mirror, they're both about Tolkien and history, but here we have a book that's principally about Tolkien and geography.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the book represents an impressive amount of research into both the places themselves and into contemporary Tolkien studies. It's really no surprise to see your own insights on every page, but it's amazing how many excellent insights you've brought in from other Tolkien scholars, some more renowned, some lesser known, about how these places left their mark on Middle-earth. So you've already touched on it here in that answer, but tell us a little bit more about your process in pulling all this together. Specifically, did you start with a list of places that you knew you wanted to explore? Or did you start by maybe going into the criticism to see what places emerged as the ones to cover?
I started with, I suppose, just a sense of places I wanted to explore, places that I knew had influenced him, or that I suspected had, or that other people claimed had. Mm-hmm. And my first thing, to be honest, was to sit and work out a pitch that I could make to the publisher. That meant that they would need to see a putative list of chapters and content. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was very rough. But at that point, I thought, well, it would be good to have a set of chapters about types of landscape, so forests, mm-hmm. Mountains, and so forth. And then chapters also about what I now think of as people in the landscape, or the impact of people on the landscape. Mm-hmm. So there you have things like towers, watchtowers, or craft and industry. And that made sense to me and seemed a rich approach, a thematic approach.
Yeah.
Then several years passed, actually, during which I worked on other things. I worked on Tolkien's Mirror. We talked with the Tolkien estate. The publisher was very keen to be able to use Tolkien's own artwork in this book. So that was a major point for them to establish before they even signed a book deal with me. Mm-hmm. And then I came back to it, and we had signed, we had a deadline, and I sat down and panicked about how little I had read in Tolkien's studies about these matters, you know, the influence of the landscape and so on. So that's what I spent the first 3 weeks or so collating material, you know, dipping into articles, reading them if they seemed particularly rich, taking copious notes. And then from there, began splitting it up into material for all the different chapters and so on and so forth. From then on, I suppose it was a pretty organic process where I was back and forth between my research and what other people had said and checking that out against my own fresh research and so on.
Hmm. Well, and I think that approach certainly shows in the book. I was actually surprised at how much material you brought in from other scholars and how much that enriched the text, because it really did present a very complete overview of some of these places, and I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to give the sense that there is an ongoing conversation on this subject. I'm certainly not the first person to set foot there.
No.
And I also wanted to be able to report fairly neutrally on some of the interesting material, the interesting claims that have been made, ones that seem well-researched and quite cogent, even if I don't necessarily want to endorse them.
Right.
So, you know, if I mention something in the book, it doesn't mean I think, oh, this is absolutely true, but it means I think it's worth your attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in the introduction to the book, you say that it is written to be read in order, but also to reward browsing. You just talked a little bit about sort of the inception of it as sort of a coffee table book around Tolkien's places. And so that certainly makes sense, you know, when you talk about something that rewards browsing. What I found as I read through it, and I did read through it in order, but I found it a bit like a tour through the places that inspired Professor Tolkien. But as you hinted at just a moment ago, instead of moving from place to place geographically, you know, maybe starting at a certain point and then just sort of meandering around the English countryside to get to different places, you move through them thematically. And you did just sort of hit on that a moment ago, following these threads of ideas from, to me, it was almost so you're starting at a point in Middle Earth and you're following the thread of an idea to a place in the real world that inspired it. Was that, again, I'll sort of ask a question about intention. Was that something that you landed on as sort of this is the best way to arrange this text? Was it primarily to reward browsing, as you put it, or was there something else at work with that approach?
It was all accidental. I thought that it would be more straightforward than it turned out to be. So as I say, I came up with this chapter plan quite some time ago, simply to interest the publisher. Mm-hmm. When it came down to arranging the material into those chapters, I realized that I'd given myself a major headache, or rather a string of major headaches, because I had several topographical chapters and several thematic chapters. Mm-hmm. But of course, anywhere, any place that we want to talk about in Tolkien's creation is liable to fit into both topographical and thematic chapters, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in the opening chapter, I talk about Tolkien's encounter with England as a young child and the impact that has in the Shire, in Hobbiton. But in a later chapter, I want to discuss a very complex idea about how the Shire and the Elven Kingdom of Lindon equate to the geography of Britain with the Celtic West and the Anglo-Saxon, the English main area to the east and the Midlands. So there's a case where I end up having to, of course, put cross-references, you know, see page, blah, blah, blah. And this happens an awful lot because the topic is not, it's three-dimensional. You can't go through it in a single line. You have to zigzag. Another thing that I did was I realized that to try to structure chapters as continuous pieces of prose, even though they had so many disparate places mentioned and arguments discussed, was virtually impossible.
Yeah.
So I came up with this idea of using panels for certain nuggets of information, certain sort of sideline discussions, things that are fascinating themselves. I think some of the panels are the most interesting things in the book myself. Mm-hmm. It's something that I tried out in Tolkien at Exeter College, and I thought it was very effective there.
Yeah.
And I think it works nicely here. It does mean that you cannot read the book as a continuous piece of prose. You have to dip. You know, I don't know how you did it, whether you just found a space on the page which seemed like a natural pause and then read the panel on that page.
That's exactly how I did it. Yep.
That's what I did as well.
Put my thumb next to a particular
spot,
read the panel. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a lot like our show. We digress all the time.
Right.
It is sequential, but it's the same thing. We stop the main thread and you pick up something else that's interesting and you spark the reader's interest and then you come back to the piece. So, yeah.
So I'm hoping, though, that, you know, that there will be people, of course, who don't read books from cover to cover, and this book will suit them very well as well.
Yes, it will.
I'm hoping that there will be things in there that people discover for the first time when looking at the book for the 30th time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think they will. I think people, as you said, this is a book that people can just pick up and just start flipping through. And their eye will be caught by a beautiful picture because there are so many beautiful pictures in it.
Or
a panel. And I think those panels are going to be the ones that are going to catch people's eyes as they're flipping through quickly. And as you said, John, those are some of the most interesting and surprising stories, bits of information in the book. So
definitely. Well, on the topic of thematic presentation, each chapter, of course, as we talked about, is focused on a particular theme. Some chapters, like Tree-Woven Lands or Roots of the Mountains, are focused on natural features, while others seem to be focused on humans' impact on the world around us, things like craft and industry or places of war. So maybe what were your differences in approaching each of these two sets of themes?
I think each chapter was a very unique process. It was all about assessing the material on hand.
Okay.
And putting it in an order that made sense. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very difficult. I mean, to be honest, I had to learn how to write again in a sense, because it's many years since I wrote Tolkien and the Great War. That was not an easy book to write. A lot of the challenge was what to include, what to exclude, and what order to put it in. And the same challenge applied here. I had set out with this book, in fact, to try to treat it as a piece of journalism. So that's my background.
Yeah.
I worked in newspapers for many years, and I have quite a lot of experience of writing features. I've written features, you know, quite fast, rarely taking more than a couple of days for 1,000 words. And I figured that I could do this with this book. But because of the complexity, the scope, that proved impossible. It took me quite a bit longer. And yes, getting the sequence of information right and deciding what was going to be included in any given chapter.
Yeah.
I had a major headache. So there's a chapter in there called Four Winds, where I talk not specifically about geography, but I talk about place in the sense of culture. I talk about the influence of different cultures on Tolkien. And so I talk obviously about his northern influences, his inspirations from Germanic lore and legend. But I also talk about his influences from Celtic lore and legend. And there was a point where I wanted to do a segue between these two, focusing on the work of the explorer Nansen. Mm-hmm. Now, Nansen wrote a fabulous book called In Northern Mists, which is a history of the understanding of the polar regions. It doesn't come up to the modernity. It turns out to be a really in-depth and fascinating, nuggety discussion of how the world was opened out from classical times onwards. Mm-hmm. And there's a great deal in there about the collision between Celtic culture and Germanic culture, so Iceland and Scandinavia.
Oh, okay.
And how these two fed into each other in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I know that this is a book that Tolkien mentions in a footnote to On Fairy Stories. I since discovered from Christopher Tolkien, in fact, shortly before he died, he got his son Adam to dig that book out from an upstairs room, and he was able to tell me the date that his father had written in that book. And he got it quite early on, and I think it's a major influence on Tolkien. And I wanted to use that, sorry, this has been a large digression, but I wanted to use that book to segue from Tolkien's northern influences, the North Wind, to his Celtic influences, the West Wind. And I spent a long time trying to hammer out the passage, and then suddenly I realized, no, this is all about the sea. This belongs in the sea chapter, you know. So that was that's the kind of problem that you have. It's like a jigsaw, essentially, except there's no picture on the front of the box when you start. Right.
John, what was the name of that? Who was that author in that book that you just mentioned?
His name is, now I'm going to mispronounce this because I'm not sure how you pronounce the first name, but Fridtjof Nansen. He was a Danish explorer and statesman. And he published this book in 1911 or 10, I forget off the top of my head. And it was very, very controversial because he argues, well, we all know that it wasn't Columbus who reached America first. It was the Vikings, right? This is all based on information from Icelandic saga about Vinland. Nansen argues that Vinland is not a real place. It is not America. He doesn't actually say they didn't get to the Americas because the sagas mention four different regions, any of which sound like American mainland or one of the islands off the American mainland, at least. But he points out that Vinland, with its self-sowing wheat and freely wild-growing grapevines, sounds very reminiscent of traditional lands of bliss, islands of good fortune that have been talked about in legend and myth for hundreds, possibly thousands of years. And his theory was that the true history of the Norse explorations westward from Iceland, by the time it was actually written down, which was a century or two after the events, had become intermingled with folklore. And you can see, you can immediately see that this is the kind of thing that would have fascinated Tolkien.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, right away I think of, you know, stories of St. Brendan and things like that. And I'm also thinking about the complicated history of Dorwinian that is in the history of Middle-earth. And how that is a real place in Middle Earth, though it's never, it's not always clear exactly where it is on the Middle Earth map, but then how it also just, the name just sort of evokes this place of eternal youth and this sort of land of bliss, as you said, John. So that's really interesting.
Well, that is.
And I noticed as I was reading the book that there is a very strong sense of sort of multiple Englands that influence Tolkien. Do you feel that that is something that carries through into Middle Earth, being this land of so many cultures as it is, and so many of these cultures being from different places throughout the history of Western civilization, you know, sort of the Rohirrim being inspired by one group, the people of Gondor being inspired by another, and so forth.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I suppose I think that's been under-recognized, even, you know, as a fact of life in Britain, that we know in the abstract that it's divided into Wales, Scotland, England. And of course, there's Ireland as well, which was at one time politically part of Great Britain. And we also know, if anyone knows a bit about the history of the islands, knows something about the sequence of invasions. And Irish mythology has this whole sequence of invasions actually embedded in the mythology. But I didn't appreciate how well this matched Tolkien's idea of a world full of peoples with their own individual histories, a multi-threaded world, you know. And that's, I think that's one of the chief appeals of Middle Earth, isn't it? That we're constantly encountering, either encountering people for the first time or enriching our understanding of them as these threads weave into one another.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, now some of the places that you write about in the book are going to be familiar to Tolkien readers. Of course, you talk about Saerhol and Cheddar Gorge and Lauterbrunnen, places like that.
Right.
Was there any inspirational place that you came across in your research that really surprised you? Something that you weren't expecting to find, but that sort of came up and that made it into the book? Any new personal favorite stories of inspiration you've discovered as you've been working on the book? I have to say, my personal favorite was the Yorkshire Sea Cave that you talked about that was said to be inhabited by Hobhole Hob. And you said that he might have been an inspiration for Gollum and hobbits at the same time. I'm curious if there were any of those that just really sort of really caught your fancy.
Yeah, well, Hobhole Hob is great fun. And I think my contribution, he's been mentioned before, my contribution there is to identify the fact that he was mentioned in a book of folklore by a close friend of Tolkien's, published in 1915 at a time, I think it was 1915, but anyway, at a time when Tolkien was going round to this close friend's house for Sunday dinners. So it seemed to me pretty obvious that that's the kind of material that they would have discussed around the dinner table. This is Elizabeth M. Wright, the wife of the great Yorkshire philologist Joseph Wright, who was Tolkien's tutor at Oxford. So yeah, that was one of them, but not strictly a discovery of mine. And that's speculative. The one that I'm really pleased with is actually the tower that I think influenced at long remove several Middle-earth towers, including the elven towers that look out westwards from the Tower Hills near the Shire, and also Orthanc. And to explain all the connections would take too long, but I will go to the point of origin very briefly. So sure. I was browsing through a book called Romantic Moderns, and at some point soon the name of the author might come back to me, and I saw an image that reminded me very much of one of Tolkien's pictures.
Okay.
And if you get the book, you'll see which one I'm talking about. And when I started investigating that picture, it's a painting of a place called Farringdon Folly, which is about 18 miles west of Oxford. So it's local to Oxford. And I looked into the history of Farringdon Folly. So a folly is a building that is built with no purpose, except to be.
Right.
And they were very, very popular from kind of the Romantic era, from the late 18th century, right through the 19th century. People would build them in the grounds of stately homes or on high hills to get fabulous views over the landscape. And pretty much the last folly of any significance that was built was Farringdon Folly, which went up in the 1930s near Oxford. And it turned out it went up at a time when Tolkien was writing his lecture material that ended up as Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics, his landmark 1936-1937 lecture on the old English poem Beowulf. And very famously, Tolkien uses an allegory in this paper to describe the way in which the poem Beowulf, this work of art, has been misused and abused by research that takes the art into account not at all. So used and abused by people who are only interested in language change or in archaeology or whatever. So all these experts had dug away at Beowulf. Tolkien came up with this allegory, which has a field full of rubble. A man takes the rubble, he builds a tower out of it. His neighbours, who can't see the point of the tower, knock it over and start rooting around among the rubble.
Yeah.
And the punchline to all this is that, you know, what they didn't understand is that from the top of that tower, the man had been able to see the sea. So it's this great idea of imagination, the power of the imagination that these mere academics can't grasp. Now, you can't see the sea from the top of Farringdon Folly, but the fact is that it was built at a time when Tolkien was writing that paper. And in fact, he changed the allegory into a tower from, of all things, a rock garden. And my theory is that he did this because he heard all about the controversy surrounding the building of Farringdon Folly, because the neighbours around Farringdon Folly did not want it built. They challenged it. They were furious about it. It made the local papers. It made even the national papers because it was being built by quite an eccentric, famous eccentric called Lord Berners, who was already the stuff of gossip columns. So that was lovely. I'm very, very proud of that. I think it's as near as certain that it influenced Tolkien in the sense that he cannot have been ignorant of the fact that this tower was going up or of the controversy surrounding it. And in mentioning it in a lecture at that time, he cannot have been ignorant of the fact that people in the audience would have known about it too. Mm-hmm. I think that he played it for laughs.
Mm-hmm. Huh. I do recall that story from the book, and I remember making a note to myself as I was reading it about how much more interesting that is than any of the other so-called tower stories that people tell about, you know, there. Well, I think Alan's got a question in here about the so-called two towers of Birmingham, but just how much more interesting that line of reasoning was than so many of the other, let's just come right out and say, those stories that are just based on nothing, you know, and this was so much more interesting than any of those. I thought it was just fascinating.
Agreed. Though that question actually is coming up next.
Oh, good.
The one about the two towers.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
So, John, along the way in the book, you debunk several myths about Tolkien's inspirations as well, like Sean just suggested, the so-called Two Towers of Birmingham, as well as the church door at Stow-on-the-Wold that some believe inspired the Doors of Durin. Those both come to mind. Now, you address the problem of misinformation right in your introduction. It's easier to identify possible influences than it is to confirm them, and tourist offices and business owners all over England take advantage of this. Now, everybody seems to want to stake their claim to inspiring some part of Middle-earth. Is this inevitable for a work as successful as Tolkien's, or is maybe there something particular to Middle Earth that makes people want to be a part of its legacy, even if it does mean clinging to loose ends like this?
I think you hit the two nails on the head. Yes, it's a very successful cultural work. So, yes, people are fascinated by it. I think you'll find that, you know, if you're interested in Jane Austen or Daphne du Maurier or Thomas Hardy, you will be interested in seeing real places that inspired them.
True.
And speculating about others. Oh, that reminds me of that place in Return of the Native or Rebecca or whatever,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Now, the other aspect with Tolkien is that it's all in an imaginary world. And we all, well, at least we did before Peter Jackson arrived, we all conjure images for that world from our own imaginations. And that means that we are drawing on our own memories or on things that, you know, we encounter while we're reading it, or maybe later on, you know, we come to somewhere and we think, oh, you know, wow, that looks so much like I imagine the Barrow Downs, you know, that kind of thing. So, yes, we want to be part of the book. And actually, that's a profound truth about how literature works. We do, as readers, we dance with the author. You know, we bring our own knowledge, our own memories, our own feelings to fill the gaps that the author leaves. So Tolkien rarely goes into great detail about a landscape scene. You may think otherwise. I mean, the Lord of the Rings especially is full of fabulous landscape writing. If you look at it closely, however, you'll see that it's all suggestive rather than specific. And then sometimes there are scenes where, you know, you think that you've imagined the setting. And if you look at the text, there is no description whatsoever of the setting. Now, this is true of the Council of Elrond, right?
True.
There's nothing there. He focuses entirely on the people in the room and what they say to each other.
Right.
So, yeah, we want to invest ourselves in it. And I think that means also that if we have strong feelings about a real place, and we've heard that Tolkien knew that place, or we speculate that he may have been to that place, we want there to be a connection. Having said that, that leads so easily into wishful thinking. And it does need to be examined, cross-examined with the evidence of what actually happened in Tolkien's life. So I saw a really interesting video on YouTube just yesterday, an interview with an Irish woman who remembers Tolkien from when he used to go over to Ireland as an external examiner in the late 1940s. And she's pretty clearly telling the truth. You know, she has the air of truth. She remembers him. It's a quirky anecdote about picking cowrie shells on a beach. And there's another little video with an academic from Ireland, and she wonders why it is that Tolkien's link with Ireland has not been more closely explored. Now, the problem is that people don't look at the chronology. Tolkien started visiting Ireland after he'd written the bulk of The Lord of the Rings. It's impossible, therefore, for him to hit the landscapes of The Lord of the Rings to have been influenced by those visits, unless he was a time traveler, which
I think he wanted to be, but I don't think he actually was.
And this happens over and over again. And then you mentioned the Two Towers of Birmingham. Yes, well, these two towers, there were two of them, and they were just up the road from Tolkien's address, where he lived for a couple of years when he was young, and those were formative years. But the big, big problem with the idea that those two towers influenced the two towers of the title of the second volume of The Lord of the Rings is simply that that title was a title of convenience stuck on that section of the book, because the publisher insisted the whole story be divided into three. We don't even know if Tolkien came up with it or if Rainer Unwin, the publisher, came up with it, or Stanley Unwin. It's impossible to know.
And Tolkien wouldn't even really commit to which two towers in Middle-earth those two towers were. So
that's right.
If we don't even know which two towers they are in Middle-earth, trying to find a real world referent for both of them is just grasping, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I can't find any reference to those two towers of Birmingham being referred to as the two towers until into the 1990s and 2000s when it comes from Tolkien's title. So it's been carried back and applied to those towers because of Tolkien,
which
completely muddies the issue.
Right.
Boy, it does, doesn't it?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Four Winds chapter, because, and you mentioned this a moment ago, John, the idea that there are some chapters that focus more on cultural inspirations, place as a sense of the identity of a people as opposed to a specific physical place. And the Four Winds chapter was absolutely wonderful. If I can just gush about it for a little bit, I thought it was really a wonderful read. And I think one of the things that was most eye-opening to me about it, well, there were several, but for example, in this chapter, you talk about some very surprising cultural inspirations for Tolkien. I think most readers know that Tolkien was influenced by Germanic myths. I think quite a few of his readers know that he was influenced by Celtic myths, and you mentioned that a little bit earlier. I don't think there are too many Tolkien readers out there who realize that The Last of the Mohicans was an influence, or the Assyrian creation myth were influences on Tolkien. And yet you have found these little nuggets that I don't think that most people are even remotely aware of. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that process was like as you're finding these? Were any of these surprises to you? And what would you like Tolkien fans to know about Tolkien, or what have you learned about Tolkien based on some of these surprising inspirations from all directions of the compass?
So let's talk about the Mesopotamian creation mythology. What I'm actually referring to there is an 1876 attempt to translate a cuneiform tablet from Nineveh, from a lost library at Nineveh in present-day Iraq. And that was brought to my attention by Peter Gilliver, who works for the Oxford English Dictionary and has co-authored a fabulous book called The Ring of Words, which I always recommend to anyone who's interested in Tolkien and his use of language. So Peter had taken part in a choral performance. He sings in Oxford choirs, where there were readings in between the singing, and one of the readings sounded remarkably like Tolkien's own creation myth, the Ainur Lindelei and the Silmarillion, the music of the Ainur.
Yeah.
And when I looked at the text of this cuneiform tablet, transliterated and translated, the very first name just leapt out at me, because the word for God in Akkadian, the language of Mesopotamia, was Ilu, I-L-U.
Oh my.
And I knew that Tolkien had first called Ilúvatar, the god figure in the Silmarillion, Ilu. So there we are. And there are other reasons for seeing a connection between these two things. And I've written a paper which has been published, and it will feed also into my other book, Tolkien's Mirror, mm-hmm. I plan, which draws all these threads together and makes I think, a pretty concrete case that Tolkien knew that material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what I draw from all this about Tolkien is that he was a magpie, a jackdaw, a thief. he had not only a fertile imagination, but a hunger for stimulus. And he dived on things and just immersed themselves in them, to mix metaphors rather horrendously. And then, you know, he'd be fascinated by something from one culture or one piece of history, and then by something else and something else too. And he would find ways of always weaving them together. So he talks about this in one of his letters. He talks about how his story of Turin Turambar is really a mixture of the story of Kullervo from the Finnish Kalevala, the national epic of Finland, and Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, the figure that many of us know as Siegfried from Wagner's Ring Cycle, but long predating Wagner, and Oedipus from Greek mythology.
Yeah.
That's precisely Tolkien's method. He's a synthesist as well. He's a master synthesist, someone who can take things from the real world, put them together, give them a new coat of varnish so that they look like his own.
Yeah.
And of course, he brings something to them too from his own resources, which is extremely powerful because he was such a fabulous storyteller.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, John. I think that was actually exactly what I wanted to hear about the Mesopotamian creation myth. What about some of those American influences? You do talk about Last of the Mohicans in the book. I believe you also talk about Longfellow's Hiawatha in the book. And I know you've written some articles on Tolkien and Longfellow as well. And they were both influenced by the Kalevala, which you mentioned a moment ago. Anything else that you can tell us about some of those surprising American influences that Tolkien might have had? I think coming to Tolkien's work as an American, I never think of him being inspired by any kind of American culture. And,
no,
and yet there might be some little seeds out there.
Well, he's got quite a connection with Longfellow. That's clear. Christopher Tolkien told me that, of course, he knew Longfellow. So that's good to know, but I think we could assume that anyway. Longfellow may not be on the cultural landscape for the kids of today, or even of my day especially, but they were. He was on the landscape very much so when Tolkien was young. And Tolkien knew the Song of Hiawatha. Now, when I read it with that in mind, I was repeatedly struck by similarities in material. And the one thing that I read where my jaw dropped is the origin of a piece that I ended up writing for the Guardian newspaper, which you can find online, where Hiawatha has gone into a kind of cursed land. It's under the curse of a kind of spirit, a kind of demonic spirit of wealth, who wears a coat of wampum, which means the kinds of beads that were used for exchange, financial exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And Hiawatha is running out of arrows and doesn't seem to be able to defeat this monster until a bird comes down near his ear and whispers to him that the monster has a weak spot and he should just aim for that. And he does, and he defeats the beast. And, of course, that is so like The Hobbit.
Yeah.
And in all its complexities, so like The Hobbit, even down to the coat of wealth, you know. So Smaug, his protection is the wealth upon which he lies. That it's impossible, I think, that Tolkien could have conceived that by coincidence. Hmm. And since we know he knew the Song of Hiawatha, we know that he cannot have been ignorant of it.
Right.
So it seems to me quite clear that Tolkien deliberately adapted that idea of Hiawatha's, of Longfellow's, or rather, I should say, of course, that idea, that tradition from the mythologies that Longfellow himself had adapted.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And to Tolkien, that would have been a perfectly respectable thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, course. He would see himself as one of a long line of storytellers, reshaping material for their own ends.
So much of this, I mean, I'm reminded of Vaughn Ferry's stories in the talk about the soup, of course. And yeah, this is simply taking these inspirational sources and molding something new from them. It's not the same story. It can't be the same story because it's not told by the same person. And that alone makes it new. And it is fascinating to dig deep. But yeah, that got to keep that in mind, of course. You know, that we're definitely looking deep into the bones of the soup here for sure.
Yeah, and Tolkien was, you know, rightly wary of putting all of that up front. I always see him as a poker player. So, you know, he holds his cards yes. close to his chest.
True.
And to some extent, the joy of reading, especially for the first time, is very much wrapped up with the feeling that this is original, this is new, this is something unprecedented. It's happening in front of our eyes.
Right.
But for those who are already familiar with Middle Earth, I think it enriches things to see how much it is interconnected with wider cultures and and landscape and so on and so forth.
Agreed. We love digging into it for that exact reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, coming back to the book, the words are excellent, of course, and as your words we would expect them to be, but the pictures are just breathtaking. Every page, practically, includes some sort of amazing illustration, either artworks, some by Tolkien, some by others, archival images, as well as current photographs of many of the places that you talk about. Now, there's a huge page of picture credits in very teeny tiny font in the back of the book. So maybe this is a huge question, but we'd love to hear more about how those pictures and all those images came together. What was that process like?
So the publisher asked me for a list of places from each chapter that might suggest visual material.
Okay.
And I did. And in many cases, I was able to pinpoint exactly what image I thought would work.
Oh, okay.
So when it came to, you know, using Tolkien's artwork, for example,
right,
a picture of one of his pictures of Rivendell was absolutely vital for the chapter about mountains because it's so visually strikingly similar to photographs of the Valley of Lauterbrunnen in Switzerland, which we know he visited. Having created some quite extensive lists for each chapter, the picture researcher went away and came up with some suggestions. And I went over that very, very carefully and made lots of counter suggestions or further suggestions, said where I didn't think certain images were adequate. Mm-hmm. I went and dug around in, you know, online picture libraries myself or in books that I happen to own for other material, which I thought raised the bar.
Okay.
And then the further stage was having agreed on that set of potential pictures, the designers went to work laying out the pages, and I was sent a draft layout, and I went through that again and pinpointed those pictures that I thought didn't work or were on the wrong pages or were used too large or too small, and I looked for parts of the text that really required illustration where that had somehow in this process been omitted. Mm-hmm. And so it was a long process.
Yeah.
It was fascinating, at times very frustrating, because you realize that after all, people can't read your mind. You just have to communicate. And thankfully, the publishers were incredibly patient with me because I'm quite pernickety and demanding. And I think they sensed that, you know, most or perhaps all of what I was saying was likely to make the book a better book.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the whole goal. That's, I mean, it's great to see that you were able to team up with them. I was afraid that the answer was going to be, oh, well, I just told my publisher and they got all the pictures together.
That would have been a terrible answer. That's what they said would happen. They said that I really didn't need to worry about it beyond making suggestions. But, when I had the book in front of me, I figured, well, actually, you know, this is a very specialist subject.
Yes.
I have a lot of information and more than information. Mm-hmm. I suppose now instincts about what matters that they don't share. So I was able to give that input. For their part, you know, they were great at chasing down beautiful pictures, photographs of the landscape that I wouldn't have been able to find. So, yeah, even in the, you know, the 11th hour, I would say, well, you know, yes, we've got a really beautiful picture here, but it's not quite what I want because it's not somewhere that we know influenced Tolkien. I would rather have one of here instead.
Yeah.
And a few days later, they would say, what about this one? And it was
nicely
perfect.
Done. Excellent.
Great.
Well, the photographer in me had to ask that question. My other day job is an architectural photographer, but my passion in photography is landscape photography. So I was very inspired by a number of the images I saw. And of course, I've always wanted to shoot over there. So one of these days.
Well, and just from my perspective, I am not a photographer, any kind of visual artist, but just seeing the pictures that were used in the book, it really just made the places come to life. And I think that was such a key part of experiencing the book for me was seeing those pictures. So
my only frustration is that there aren't more pictures because there's plenty of scope for more, you know, and there was some that dropped because permissions or costs or quality. There's one in particular of the bridge at Great Heywood where Tolkien lived with Edith in the winter of 1916-17 when he was straight back from the Battle of the Somme and was beginning the Book of Lost Tales, and it shows the landscape under snow. It was a very, very cold winter, 1917. Yeah. This photograph wasn't a 1917 archive photograph. It was a modern photo, but it was absolutely exquisite, and it just captured the atmosphere for me. But we couldn't use it because the photographer couldn't locate his original
raw files.
You
don't want to reproduce a compressed JPEG and turn that into a print. No,
that's it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Well, John, we'd like to close out on a slightly different topic here today. Earlier this year, of course, we all mourned the passing of Christopher Tolkien, and you wrote an obituary for him in The Guardian, which our listeners can read online, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes for this episode.
Yes.
In that article, you wrote about the kinship of spirit that Christopher shared with his father. You talked about his vital insight in bringing so much unfinished material to light after his father's death in 1973. You also quoted the author Neil Gaiman as saying, "It feels like Christopher lets us into his father's mind, lets us walk the road as J.R.R.T. walked it." And I think that sums up why Christopher Tolkien's death was just much more of a blow to fans of J.R.R.'s work than, I'd have to say, than just about any other child of a writer that we can imagine.
Yeah.
Would you mind saying just a few words for us now about Christopher's legacy, both how you feel as a fan and a scholar yourself, but also just the debt that Tolkien fans everywhere owe to him?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just think that we all knew of Christopher's importance as the editor of the Silmarillion and of Unfinished Tales and the 12-volume History of Middle-earth and other books, I think 24, 25 posthumous titles of his father's works. But I don't think it's until he was gone and you knew there would be nothing more from him that you realized just how vital he had been. And it wasn't really until I sat down to write that obituary that I fully appreciated it. And, you know, looking at his early interaction with his father, listening to The Hobbit and picking his father up on inconsistencies like, you know, the color of Thorin's hat or beard or whatever, you know, the color of Bilbo's front door changing from scene to scene. And, you know, it's clear that Christopher was not only an arch fan of his father's work. He just absolutely adored it.
Yeah.
He was enveloped in it in a way that I suspect no one else ever has been, perhaps not even Tolkien himself, because he was a primary audience from the cradle onwards.
Yeah, it's true.
And also just deeply attuned to it. I mean, the first thing is true, I suppose, probably of all the Tolkien children, but Christopher was so much more deeply attuned to it, I think. And you can see that in the fact that he went into the same career as his father, as an Oxford medievalist and philologist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, absolutely key. And something comes from that when he is assessing his father's work, whether that be for in order to produce the Silmarillion, or whether it be for laying out the history of Middle-earth in all its complexity. Mm. And that is an instinct that comes from deep familiarity, intimacy, and love.
Yeah.
And that's irreplaceable.
It is.
And also, he could read his father's handwriting, which is...
equally irreplaceable.
Quite a feat, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're not kidding about that. Well, John, we can't thank you for joining us enough. We are so glad to have been able to have you back on for a full episode again, and to have you keep that record going now, being our most frequently appearing guest. You know this already, I'm sure, but we would be thrilled to have you back on the show at any time.
Well, thank you very much again. It's great to speak to you.
And folks listening at home, thank you for joining us as well. We hope you'll join us again next week.
But until then, we want you to remember that the talk continues all night long at the Prancing Pony.
That's right. We've always got lots of discussion happening on our social media spaces. At our Common Room on Facebook, you'll find comments, questions, corrections, and more on every episode, as well as updates from us throughout the week. Just look for the Prancing Pony Podcast on Facebook and click the like and follow buttons.
And now we have another Common Room over on Reddit. You can find great discussions there at r/PrancingPonyPod. As always, you can find us on Twitter and on Instagram with the handle @PrancingPonyPod. So follow us wherever you happen to be. And if you like us, share us on Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, wherever you can find Tolkien fans.
And if you really want to let the world know your feelings about us, give us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more reviews we have, the more visible our podcast is, and that helps others find us and this great community of Tolkien fans we've built together.
Indeed. Now, if you'd like access to some exclusive content like postscripts, quarterly specials, a little PPP swag, and more, you're going to want to check out patreon.com/prancingponypod to find out how you can join the fellowship of the podcast. But folks, that is going to wrap it up for another episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Be sure to join us again next week when we get back to the text of The Lord of the Rings with the first part of The Mirror of Galadriel.
And that's when Frodo meets somebody else who has fancy jewelry like he does. Although I guess he's not going to find out that she has that fancy jewelry for a few more episodes.
No, that is true. Now, as always, folks, we want to thank each of you for listening. But we also want to give a very special thank you to our patrons at the Círdan's Contribution tier. James in Virginia, Tamsin in Minnesota, Chad in Texas, Lance in New Jersey, Paul in Colorado, Jerry in Texas, Bruce in California, Mario in Utah, Seth in Texas, Ella in California, Joseph in Texas, and Kathy from North Carolina. Thank you all so very much.
And make sure you don't miss a single episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing, as always, don't forget to send your questions, comments, and this time, most of all, your personal photos of any of the places we've talked about to Barlamin at theprancingponypodcast.com.
Well, Barlamin's never punctual with the mail, but we've gotten used to it by now. And we will get back to you as soon as we can. And your question or comment may be featured on an upcoming show.
Well, this has been far too short a time to spend among such excellent and admirable listeners. But until next time.
Farewell, friends.